And the reader is poet Stephen Orlin of our own creative writing faculty. I hope you can come to the student union following tonight's reading to meet Mr. Michaels. We'll be in the Terrace Lounge, which is the most inaccessible spot in the union, on the third floor, just as far west as you can go, and around the tables and through the forest. We had hoped to publish a creative writing newsletter in the middle of October, but it will be rather short unless you give us some material. Our policy, of course, is to publish only good news, honors and publications and awards. So if you don't want to feel that you're tooting your own horn, let one of your friends do it for you and stick a note in our box or give us an anonymous telephone call. Your friends do want to know what you're doing. They do like to hear about nice things that happen to you. So give us a chance to publicize it. Leonard Michaels comes to us from the University of California at Berkeley. He's published two collections of short stories, Going Places, which was a National Book Award nominee, and I would have saved them if I could. His essays and reviews have appeared in the New York Times Book Review, Partisan Review, New Republic, and other magazines. He's co-editor of a book of essays, The State of the Language. He's on food, a Guggenheim Fellowship, an award from the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities, and the O. Henry Prize. Those of you who had an opportunity to hear him read for us at an informal reading 2 years ago know that you have a big treat in store, Mr. Leonard Michaels.
Most of the material that I'll read from is very short, and it'll pretty much represent samples from my work at all stages. I'll end with a reading from a section of my novel, which has just been completed. All I've got to do is find my glasses. Okay, this is a story, very short, it's only a paragraph long. It appeared in American Review. It's called Pretty Women. Kittredge loves pretty women, but he is blind. He can't pursue them. So I take him to a party and describe a woman in the room. He whispers, "Is she pretty? Tell me about her neck." Eventually, I introduce him to her, and they leave the party together. Kittredge is always successful. Women think he listens differently from other men. In his blind hands, they think pleasure is truth. Blind hands know deep particulars, what yearns in the knee and neck. I suppose women also imagine themselves beautifully reciprocal, embracing Kittredge with goodness the way sunlight takes a tree. He says, "Talk about her hips." He wants badly to assimilate the pretty ones. As I talk, his eyes slide with meanings, rather like eyes in a normal face, except quicker, something fearful snapping at them. Kittredge cannot see, cannot know if a woman is pretty. I say, "She has thick black hair." When they leave together, I begin to sink. I envy the magnetic darkness of my friend. To envy him without desiring his condition is possible. The next is called Imagine a Man. Kafka imagines a man. He has a hole in the back of his head. The sun shines into this hole. Anyone can look into this hole. The man himself is denied a glimpse of it. Naturally, it is in the back of his head. But Kafka might well be talking about the man's face. Only other people, never the man himself, see it directly. Others even look into it as if it were a hole. The most public, most promiscuous part of the man's body is thus essentially invisible to himself. How obvious. Still, it takes a genius to say that our most visible thing, what eats, kisses, whistles, moans, is to each of us more private than our privates. However, there is a moment when you see it directly, as if with the eyes of another. It happens through a freak of circumstances when you are surprised in a mirror. Your face is then stunningly plain, as never else, not even when photographed or drawn. In such case, it is distorted by the mediating instruments. Worse, it is qualified by time, instantly and forever. When photographed, your face is younger than you are. But surprised in a mirror, it is given to you actual, living now. You fail to know who, let alone what, it is. Then gradually, at the intersection of familiarity and strangeness, it begins looking at you with the same question as exists in yourself looking at it. Such rare sympathy is difficult to sustain. You retreat from it and settle again into quotidian blindness, the blindness of your face to itself. But now you want to light a cigarette or fix yourself a drink. You want to make a phone call. To whom? You don't know. Of course you don't. You want to phone your face, the one you've never met, who you are. The next is called You. Begins with a quote from Kafka. Every time I went to close the window, I saw a grocery store on the other side of the marketplace. This is Kafka's diaries. I could say why it is marvelous, but that would be like saying to your lover in a moment of sacred intimacy, aren't we having fun? Suddenly the room is full of ghouls. You emptied the world. Nothing remains but you, 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 you. Now I'm going to read a slightly longer story. This is from my first book. It's called Crossbones. At the end of the summer, or the year, or when he could do more with his talent than play guitar in a village strip joint, and after considering his talent for commitment and reluctance, she found reluctance in her own heart, and marriage talk became desultory, specifics dim, ghostly, lost in bed, Byron doing wrong things, working on her, discovering epileptic dysrhythmia in her hips. And he asked about it, and she said it hurt her someplace, but not, she insisted, in her head. And they fought the next morning and the next, as if ravenous for intimacy, and disgraced themselves, yelling, becoming intimate with neighbors, and the superintendent brought them complaints which would have meant nothing if they hadn't exhausted all desire for loud, broad strokes. But now, conscious of complaints, they thrust along the vital horizontal with silent, stiletto words. And later in the narrowed range of their imaginations could find no adequate mode of retraction. So wounds festered, burgeoning lurid weeds, poisoning thought, dialogue. And the simple air of their two-room apartment, which had seemed, with its view of the Jersey cliffs, so much larger than now, seemed too thick to breathe or to see through to one another. But they didn't say a word about breaking even experimentally. For whatever their doubts about one another, their doubts about others and the city, themselves adrift in it among messy one-night stands, were too frightening. And at least they had in one another what they had. Sarah had Myron Bronski, gloomy brown eyes, a guitar in his hands, as mystical and tearing as, say, Lorca. Though Myron's particular hands derived from dancing, clapping Hasidim. And he had Sarah Nilsson, Minnesota blonde, long bones, Arctic schizophrenia in the gray infinities of her eyes, and a turn for lyric poems derived from piratical saga masters. Rare, but opposites cleave in the divisive angularities of Manhattan. And as the dialectics of embattled individuation became more intense, these two cleaved more tightly. If Sarah, out for groceries, hadn't returned in 20 minutes, Myron punched a wall, pulverizing the music in his knuckles, but punched and flung through the door, shrieking, "Stop!" And he, 20 minutes late from work, found Sarah in kerchief, coat, and gloves, the knotted cloth beneath her chin a little stone proclaiming wild indifference to what the nighttime street could hold, since it held most for him if she were raped and murdered in it. After work, he ran home, buying a quart of milk and a pack of cigarettes. She suffered stomach cramps. Then a letter came from St. Cloud, Minnesota. Sarah's father was coming to visit them next week. She sewed curtains, squinting down into the night, plucking thread with pricked, exquisite fingertips. He painted walls, lately punched. She bought plants for the windowsills, framed and hung three Japanese prints, and painted the whole toilet opaque, flat yellow. On his knees until sunrise, 4 days in a row, he sanded, then varnished floorboards until the oak bubbled up its blackest grain, silent and petrified. And Monday dawned on Sarah, ironing dresses, more than enough to last her father's visit, and Myron already twice shaved, shining all his shoes, urging her to hurry. In its mute perfection, their apartment now had the expressive air of a well-beaten slave, simultaneously alive and dead, and reflected like an emanation of their nerves their own hectic, mainly wordless harmony. But it wouldn't have mattered if the new curtains, pictures, and varnished floors yelled reeking spiritual shambles, because Sarah's father wasn't that kind of minister. His sermons alluded more to Heidegger and Sartre than Christ. He lifted weights, smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day, drove a green Jaguar, and, since the death of Sarah's mother a year ago in a state insane asylum, had seen species of love in all human relations. And probably at this very moment, taking the banked curves of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, knuckles pale on the walnut wheel, came man and machine leaning as one toward Jersey and beyond that toward love. Their sense of all this had driven them, wrenched them out of themselves onto their apartment until nothing more could make it coincident with what he would discover in it anyway. And they had now only their own absolute physical being still to work on at 9 o'clock when Myron dashed out to the cleaners for shirts, trousers, and jackets, then dressed in fresh clothing while Sarah slammed and smeared the iron down the board, as if increasingly sealed in the momentum of brute work, and then Myron, standing behind her, lighting a cigarette, was whispering as if to himself that she must hurry, and she was turning from the board and in the same motion hurled the iron, lunging after it with nails and teeth before it exploded against the wall, and Myron instantly, hideously understood that the iron, had it struck him, had to burn his flesh and break his bones, flew to meet her with a scream and fists banging her mouth as they locked, winding, fusing to one convulsive beast reeling off walls, tables and chairs with ashtrays, books, lamps, shooting away with pieces of themselves. And he punched out 3 of her teeth and strangled her until she dissolved in his hands and she scratched his left eye blind. But there was hope in corneal transplantation that he would see through it again. And they were strapped in bandages, twisted and stiff with pain a week after Sarah's father didn't arrive. And they helped one another walk slowly up the steps of the municipal building to buy a marriage license. Now I'll read some, again, very, very short ones. These are from my second collection of stories. I would have saved them if I could. And it's from a section of the book called Eating Out. The first is called Basketball Player. I was the most dedicated basketball player. I don't say the best. In my mind, I was terrifically good. In fact, I was simply the most dedicated basketball player in the world. I say this because I played continuously from the time I discovered the meaning of the game at the age of 10 until my mid-20s. I played outdoors on cement, indoors on wood. I played in heat, wind, and rain. I played in chilly gymnasiums. Walking home, I played some more. I played during dinner, in my sleep, in movies, in automobiles, in buses, and at stool. I played for over a decade, taking every conceivable shot with either hand from every direction. Masses cheered my performance. No intermission, no food, no other human concern. Year they cheered me on. In living rooms, subways, movies, and schoolyards, I heard them. During actual basketball games, I also played basketball. I played games within games. When I lost my virginity, I eluded my opponent and sank a running hook. Masses saw it happen. I lost my virginity and my girl lost hers. The game had been won. I pulled up my trousers. She snapped her garter belt. I took a jump shot from the corner and another game was underway. I scored in a blind drive from the foul line. We kissed goodnight. The effect was epileptic. Masses thrashed in their seats, loud holes in their faces. I acknowledged with an automatic nod and hurried down the street, dribbling. A fallaway jumper from the top of the key. It hung in the air. Then, as if sucked down suddenly, it zipped through the hoop. Despite the speed and angle of my shots, I never missed. Next is called Pleasure. My mother was taking me to the movies. We were walking fast. I didn't know what movie it would be. Neither did my mother. She couldn't read. We were defenseless people. I was 10 years old. My mother was 5 foot nothing. We walked with fast little steps, hands in our pockets, faces down. The school week had ended. I was 5 days closer to the MD. My reward for good grades was a movie, Black Brilliant Pleasure, encouragement to persist. We walked in a filthy, freezing, blazing wind for half a mile, the pleasure I'll never forget. A girl is struck by a speeding car, a beautiful girl who speaks first-class English, but she is struck down, blinded, broken, paralyzed. The driver of the car is a handsome doctor. My mother whispers, "Na," the Polish word that stimulates free associational capacities in children. Mind spring, this to that. The doctor operates on the girl in a theater of lights, masks, and knives. She has no choice in this matter, blind and broken, paralyzed. Lucky for her, she recovers. Her feeling of recovery is thrilling love for the doctor. He has this feeling, too. It spreads from them to everywhere, like the hot, vibrant, glowing moo of a tremendous cow. The world is feeling. Feeling is the deadly car, the broken girl and blinding doctor, the masks, knives, and kisses. Finally, there is a sunset. It returns me with smeared and glistening cheeks to the blazing wind. I glance at my mother. She whispers, "Nah?" Intelligence springs through my mind like a monkey seizing the bars, shaking them. We walk fast with little steps, our hands in our pockets. But my face is lifted to the wind. It shrieks, "M.D., my call." The next is called Something Evil. I said, "Ixtine stands outside the door for a long time before he knocks. Did you suspect that? Did you suspect that he stands there listening to what we say before he knocks?" She said, "Did you know you're crazy?" I said, "I'm not crazy." The expression on his face when I open the door is giddy and squirmy, as if he'd been doing something evil, like listening outside our door before he knocked. She said, "That's Ixtine's expression. Why do you invite him here? Leave the door open. He won't be able to listen to us. You won't make yourself crazy imagining it." I said, "Brilliant. But he isn't due for an hour, and I won't sit here with the door open." She said, "I hate to listen to you talk this way. I won't be involved in your lunatic friendships." She opened the door. Ixtine stood there, giddy and squirming. The next is called Answers. I began 200 hours of continuous reading and the 12 hours that remained before examinations. Melvin Bloom, my roommate, flipped the pages of his textbook in a sweet, continuous trance. Reviewing the term's work was his pleasure. He went to sleep early. While he slept, I bent into the night, reading, eating Benzedrine, smoking cigarettes. Shrieking dwarfs charged across my notes. Crabs asked me questions. Melvin flipped a page, blinked, flipped another. He effected the same flipping and blinking with no textbook during examinations. For every question, answers marched down his optical nerve, neck, arm, and out his paper, where they stopped in impeccable parade. I'd look at my paper, oily, scratched by rat-like misery, and I'd think of Melvin Bloom. I would think, oh God, what is going to happen to me? The next... Thank you. The next is called Eating Out. Four men were at the table next to mine. Their collars were open, their ties loose, their jackets hung on the wall. One man poured dressing on the salad, another tossed the leaves, another filled the plates and served. One tore bread, another poured wine, another ladled soup. The table was small and square. The men were cramped, but efficient nonetheless. Apparently practiced at eating here, this way, hunched over food, head striking to suck at spoons, tear at forks, then pulling back in studious, invincible mastication. Their lower faces slid and chopped. They didn't talk once. All their eyes, like birds on a wire, perched on a horizontal line above the action. Swallowing muscles flickered in jaws and necks. Had I touched the shoulder and asked for the time, they would have been snarling, a flash of teeth. Next is called What's New. My mother said, so what's new? I said, something happened. She said, I knew it. I had a feeling. I could tell. Why did I ask? Sure something happened. Why couldn't I sit still? Did I have to ask? I had a feeling. I knew. What happened? That's the story. The next is called The Burglar. I dialed. The burglar answered and said Ickstein wasn't home. I said, tell him I called. The burglar laughed. I said, what's funny? The burglar said, coincidence. When you called, I was reading a passage in Ickstein's diary, which is about you. I said, tell me what it says. The burglar snorted. Your request is compromising. Just hearing it is compromising. I said, I'm in the apartment below Ickstein's. We can easily meet and have a little talk about my request. I'll bring something to drink. Do you like marijuana? I know where Ickstein hides his marijuana. I have money with me, also a TV set and a Japanese camera. It's no trouble for me to carry everything up there. One trip. He said if I came upstairs, he would kill me. This is called Right Number. A girl lived in the apartment below. We became friends. I'd go there any time, early or late. She opened the door and didn't turn on the light. I undressed in darkness, slid in beside her, made a spoon, and she slid into my spoon. She had no work, nothing she had to do. No one expected her to be any place. Money came to her in the mail. She had a Goya's whore and a Botticelli face. She was tall, pale, blonde, and wavy. I knocked, she let me in, no questions. We talked fast and moved about from bed to chairs to floor. Sometimes I'd pinch her thigh. Once she knocked a coffee cup into my lap. Finally, we had sexual intercourse. We made a lot of jokes and she was on her back. I tried to be gentle. She thrashed in a complimentary way and moaned. Later, she said to guess how many men she'd had. I said 10, she said 15. How does that sound? It sounds more depraved than I feel. After the Turk, she understood the Ottoman Empire. She said people thought of her as manic depressive, but it wasn't true. She had good reasons for what she feels. Germans are friskier than you'd imagine. The right number is 7 or 8. It sounds like a lot, yet it isn't depraved. It's believable. A girl shouldn't say 7 or 8, then describe 20. What, What if I said more than 10, less than 20? How does that sound? 6 came in one weekend. They count. How old do you think I am? 28? I'm only 22. With A, it is a way of making something out of nothing. With B, it is a form of conversation. With C, it is letting him believe something about himself. With D, it's a mistake. I've had 17. People think I've had 50 or 100. Do I want 50 or 100? No. I want 25. 25 or 30. Do you remember what my face is like? I think it looks sluttish. Indians are the nicest. Blacks don't talk to you afterward. I was raped when I was a kid. Then I rode my bicycle around and around the block and talked to myself in a loud voice. All my life I've tried to keep things from getting out of hand, but I get out of hand. Nothing works. Nothing works. I like you very, very much, I said. Let's try again. I was gentle. She thrashed in a complimentary way and moaned. The next day, she knocked at my door wearing a handsome gray wool and high heels. Her hair had been washed and combed into a style. She looked neat, intelligent, and extremely beautiful. She said she was going to a job interview to have something to do. We hugged for good luck and kissed. Somehow, she was on her back. We had sexual intercourse. I wasn't gentle. She whipped in the pelvis and screamed murder. Me too. The next is called God. My mother said, what's new? I said, nothing. She said, what? You can tell me. Tell me what's new. I said, something happened. She said, I had a feeling. I could tell. What happened? I said, nothing happened. She said, thank God. The next is called Ma. I said, Ma, do you know what happened? She said, oh my God. All right, I'm going to read one that's slightly longer, and this is very obliquely political. It's, in fact, probably not political at all. It's art. Okay. It's called Trotsky's Garden. Trotsky is writing. He will mention his love of life and his unqualified faith and dialectical materialism. He will mention Natasha, the strip of green outside his window, his invincible atheism, and he will contemplate his death. It is morning. Trotsky sits at his wooden desk. He looks at letters and a blotter. The Mexican sun burns in the green outside his window, just opened by Natasha. Trotsky notices. Natasha and the green slide into his writing. A man like Trotsky in the head with a pickaxe. Trotsky's sons, murdered, are mentioned in the writing. From Russia to Mexico, friends, secretaries, and bodyguards, murdered, are mentioned in the writing. In Berlin, where he sent her for psychoanalysis, his daughter killed herself. The pen does not cease or grovel in individuals. Trotsky will mention his faith in dialectical materialism, his faith in meaning. His mother suffered difficulties in reading. She crouched over novels and said, Beta, Alpha. Trotsky says, if I could begin all over, I would try to avoid this or that mistake, but the main course of my life would remain unchanged. I shall die a proletarian revolutionist, a Marxist, a dialectical materialist. Dialectical materialism in the heat of the day draws a pickaxe from its raincoat. Some say rusty axe, others say ice pick. Trotsky himself noticed nothing. It descended from behind. But he will bite the assassin's hand. He's writing that, again, he would avoid mistakes. The sun, as it did yesterday and will tomorrow, is shining. Trotsky loves the green outside his window and flourishes it in his writing. We shout, okay, Trotsky, no time for poems. He cannot hear us. His poem is a march of corpses. The din is terrific. Feet are beating in his writing. The sun is in the green in his writing. Sadova, the aristocrat, lifts her elbow for photographers. See, a bullet made that ugly scratch. My old man isn't nobody. Yesterday, they machine-gunned our bedroom. She means, from revolution to Mexico, Trotsky is pursued by his inventions. Trotsky himself says that he put the idea of exile into the ear of Stalin's spy, hence into the mind of Stalin. In effect, Trotsky exiled Trotsky and machine-gunned his bedroom. Now writing that one cannot be reborn until one is dead, and look, it sits beside him with a raincoat and pickaxe. It makes nervous conversation alphabetical materialism. Suddenly Trotsky is fighting, not writing. Blood runs into his eyes. Nevertheless, he catches the personal fact. Who said Lenin is morally repulsive and Stalin is a savage who hates ideas and Parvus is a fat, fleshy bulldog head? Trotsky said these things. Now the assassin's hand is in his teeth. With fury of intimacy, Trotsky bites. This hand wanted to remind him of something, but what? On the wall outside, the guards carry rifles and binoculars. They are gossiping in the sun when Trotsky screams. They see him standing in the window, bleeding and blind, a figure of history. What? He screams. The assassin is behind him, bent, sobbing like a child as he sucks his mutilated hand. The guards are running on the wall with their rifles and binoculars. Freud lights a cigar and contemplates this tableau. He says, Trotsky and I were neighbors in Vienna. Trotsky admired Freud. He sent him his best daughter. Now Trotsky shouts in the window, what does it mean, heat in such heat, a raincoat? Trotsky flings toward his wooden desk. He needs only seconds to write. On hot days in Mexico, beware of raincoats. The next story I'd like to read is one that depends very, very much on kind of New York accent or New York musical phrasing. It's called Hello Jack. Jack phoned. I said, hello Jack. He said he was going to the hospital. I said, all right, I'll go with you. I asked if I should phone his wife. They weren't living together. He said he didn't want me to know, I'm sorry, he said he didn't want me to know where he was. He didn't want me to do anything. I said, you're the boss. What's wrong? I made my voice little. He yelled, let's not talk about it. I'm in the hospital. I said you had to go to the hospital. Little words, cheepy, cheepy, cheepy. His wife couldn't stand him. I knew plenty. I said, hello, Jack, and rushed to the hospital. I had a bad foot. Every step was a wolf bite. But Jack was in the hospital. He was the boss. Jack phoned, so I said, hello, taxi cab. He'd do the same for me. We were old friends from Novgorod. Nothing to think about. Taxi, taxi. In the hospital, I noticed everyone was dead. Then a nurse was walking. I yelled, rooms, rooms, rooms. She said, she personally didn't build the hospital. I said, so where's Jack? She said he was in a room with another man. In a hall, I was running. I saw Jack. Compared to the other man, Jack was Mr. Universe. What the Mongolians did to one grandmother, the Germans did to the other. They made a big, blonde Chinese Jew. His wife hated him. She was from Budapest. Say anything. What's with that man? I said. I limped to a chair and took the shoe off my bad foot. The other man was blankets up to a face the color of chicken fat. His eyes were sticking out like swords. Jack said the man was recovering from pneumonia. I didn't say anything. If you ask me, that man finished recovering, I said. I put my shoe on Jack's bed. Jack said, what's the matter with your foot? Nothing, I said. The man heard us. He said, virus. My foot was sweating. Jack said, virus is different from plain pneumonia. I rubbed my foot. Poo, I said, open a window. Jack said, don't do anything, it's not important. I said, how much are they paying you to stay here? Stinks is not important. I hopped to the window in one shoe and asked the virus, I'm opening the window. His eyes didn't move. They looked like a sign. Be quiet, be quiet. Two killers shining, pushing. He said, virus. I asked him again, I'm opening this window, stop stinking. He said, virus. A little snow came in. You couldn't notice, like feathers, nothing. It melted on the radiator. The virus didn't complain. Only a maniac would complain. The virus looked at the ceiling as if a movie was playing there. I looked too. I knew there was no movie on the ceiling, but I looked. I was right. Jack was happier with the window open. Why not? He was a man with a friend. He began a speech while he was in the hospital. He couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep, this, that. He fell down at work, in his stomach a pain, so his union sent him to the hospital. Talk, 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 I knew plenty. I said, I'm glad you want to talk. He said, is it wrong to talk? I said, tell me if what you have is serious and forgive me for laughing. A friend can laugh. He said, you think it's not serious? I said, to you, serious is to the world ridiculous. Sure, an enemy wouldn't laugh. He doesn't care, so he can care. You have no sense of proportion. I rubbed my foot. The other man said, virus. Jack said, nobody told him not to talk. I said, maybe you would like to sing. He began to sing, ya, ya, ya. The man said, virus, me too, ya, ya, ya. All of a sudden, the virus pushes his blankets on the floor and gets out of bed. His gown was pinched in his behind. His legs were bones, his face green like a tomato. I thought he was a tomato, not a virus. He walked out of the room. We stopped singing. I said he went to the toilet. Jack said, a toilet is behind the door over there. He didn't go to the toilet. I said, how do you know? Maybe he doesn't like that toilet. Jack said he didn't go to the toilet. I said, he'll be back in a minute. He went to another toilet because he didn't want us to hear him make a tinkle. Jack said he didn't go to any toilet. I said, all right. Then he recovered. Why should he pay another penny? He recovered. Stop the clock. A motel is cheaper. I noticed I had a headache. Jack gave me a face like Genghis Khan, a rock with eye slits. I could see the tomato was my fault. I could see it in the rock. I said, I know how it is, Jack. You come in with trouble, and they put you with a virus. Look at my foot. Is that sweat, Jack? It's sweat, believe me. Jack's wife hated him, a small skinny from night school, hair and pimples. She used to read to him from Goethe. He couldn't understand the words, so they got married. When Jack had a hard-on, she would vomit. He called her the stomach. He used to say, I'm going home now to the stomach. I knew plenty. I said, what do you say about my foot? He said he phoned me so I would walk on my rotten foot. Then he grabbed my shoe and went to the window. A guy like him makes life meaningless. I said, Jack, it was a shoe. You should throw Goethe out the window. Maybe you're in the Mongolian mood to throw my other shoe out the window. I slapped it on his bed. He threw it out the window. How about this lamp? I said, out the window. These blankets you want to keep? Out the window. I said, this is too big. Don't even look at it. Chinese Jew, the mattress was no trouble. A nurse came in when I was pulling Jack's bed toward the window. She started hitting and scratching me. Jack knocked her down with a punch. We were singing, ya, 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 when nurses and doctors from all over the hospital came in. Why not? How often do schmucks see a friendship? I walked home without a shoe, not one shoe. I begged myself to take a taxi. It's cold, it's snowing, take a taxi. But I refused, no taxi. For proof, I yelled, taxi, taxi. It stopped. Drive into a wall, I said. The driver looked at me. I made a Jack face. He picked up a wrench. I could see he was a maniac. I was standing without shoes, and a maniac was coming with a wrench. He could hit me in the foot. When he pushed open the door, another taxi knocked it off. It was, I yelled, but he was hitting the other driver with the wrench. In the snow, I ran away. You'll get pneumonia, I said. I said, I hope it's a virus. Then I saw a phone booth and called Jack's wife. She said, hello? I recognized her voice because it was so little and quiet. That's how she talked, like a one-year-old. I said, hello, Jack's wife? She said, yeah, Jack's wife. I said, Jack is dead. She said, what? Who? I said, you are no good, believe me. East Side Hospital. She was screaming with her little voice. What? Who? I didn't say anything. I said, I'm hanging up. You think my foot isn't killing me? What do you care? She screamed, wait, wait. I said, Jack's wife? She screamed, yeah, yeah, Jack's wife. I said, Jack's wife from Goethe? She screamed, yeah, Jack's wife. I said, listen, let another person talk sometimes. She stopped screaming. Are you listening, I said. She whispered, yes, yes. Glunk, I hung up. That night, Genghis Khan and the stomach were together. I didn't say anything. I went home and put my foot in the toilet bowl and flushed the water. Who needs a hospital or a small skinny from Budapest? Not for me. A friend calls, and I said, hello, Jack. I also have a toilet bowl. It sucks my foot, and soon it feels better. At night, I knock over the garbage bag under the sink, so in the dark, I listen to them eat. The rats are happy. I'm happy. I yell sleep. It comes like a taxi cab.